I call this meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee to order.
They also had a very good
note for the record that the quorum is present. If we could just get everyone to quiet down a little so we can get down to business right away, that would be great. We have everyone just take their voices down a little bit or take conversations out of the room. We got a full house today, so it's a little hard to hear. Thank you much. So the first order of business today is the budget resolution, and then we'll have the taxes and the health bill up. And the intent is still to finish within our allotted time and be done an hour from now, so we'll just move expediently through this. So the first order of business is the approval of minutes from Thursday, April 20th, 2023. Vice Chair Edelson, have you had a chance to review the minutes, and would you be willing to move their approval?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes have been adopted. So first up is to do an amendment to the budget resolution, and you have that in your packet. So I will move that the 2023 House Budget Resolution coded Bud Res 03-2 is in front of us. And I will also move the A01 amendment to the budget resolution. And I will turn to Colby Sullivan from House Research to walk through the changes in the amendment.
Madam Chair and members, the Bud Res 03-2-A01 amendment does three things. Lines 3 and 6 establish a balance for the stadium reserve account of $664,059,000. Line 6 of the amendment decreases the general fund target for the health finance bill by $68,819,000. That's due to the fact that Representative Neuer's House File 2286 transitioned from the public health emergency bill is moving separately and is now accounted for on line 39 of the tracking sheet under the other bills category. And then finally on line 7, the amendment will increase the healthcare access fund target for the health finance bill by $21,443,000.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sullivan.
I'm sorry, it's so loud in here. I could not hear half of what he said. Either can he speak louder and into the mic or quiet the room?
Mr. Sullivan, do it again, but it is, there's just a full house. We've been paper shuffling, side chatter. It is pretty hard to hear, so we'll be cognizant of speaking up and everybody being quiet as we can be. So, Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, can you hear me now?
Better.
The AO1 amendment does three things. It sets the budget reserve account balance on lines 4 and 5, and that balance is $664,059,000. Line 6 of the amendment decreases the general fund target for the health finance bill by $68,819,000 because Representative Neuer's House File 2286 is tracked separately on the tracking sheet that's also in your packets. And then finally on line 7, the amendment increases the health care access fund for the health finance bill by $21,443,000.
Discussion to the amendment to the budget resolution. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, then I will move the adoption of House Budget Resolution coded Bud Res 03-2 as amended. We're going to adopt the A1 amendment first. So first I will move the A1 amendment, which Mr. Sullivan just walked through. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The amendment is adopted, and now I will move the adoption of House Budget Resolution coded Bud Res 03-2 as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The budget resolution as amended is adopted. And so now on to our first of the two bills today, which is House File 1938, the House Tax Bill. So, Representative Gomez, as you get settled up there, I will move on your behalf that House File 1938 be placed on the General Register. And Representative Gomez, also have the A16 amendment. Would you just briefly describe that amendment? So, Representative Gomez moves the A16 amendment, so that's in front of us now.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the A16, my author's amendment, briefly, lines 1.2 to 1.7 make conforming changes to the definition of income for the pass-through entity tax that's included in the bill. Lines 1.8 to 1.17 make some changes to the public pension subtraction and updates the terminology used from members to former members, which is how you describe the retirees enrolled in this program. Lines 118 and 119, we sort of discovered a misalignment between the language that we had in our bill and the spreadsheet. And so this, it's actually kind of a good thing because we were carrying this number in our spreadsheet that reflects that we are able to add 18-year-olds and seniors to be able to claim the working family credit. And so this aligns the language with the number we're carrying on the spreadsheet. Lines 120 to 122 increases taxpayer assistance grant funding by $800,000 a year. Line 1.23 removes the local sales tax task force provisions or provision. Lines 2.1 to 2.28 make changes to the definition of electronic pull tab device. So we adopted, we are carrying in the DE a change to the definition of electronic pull tab games. There are two definitions in statute for the game, one for the game and one for the device. And so this adds some language to align the description of the game or the changes to that we made in the descriptions of the game to the descriptions of the devices also. Line 229 to 230 adds the Fond du Lac ban to the Tribal Nation Aid or Tribal Nation Aid and ensures that and kind of adds the allocation, which is that 50% gets distributed equally and 50% is based on each Tribal Nation's enrolled membership. So that's the author's amendment.
Thank
Madam
you,
Chair.
Representative Gomez. Discussion to the A16 amendment. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I was on the Tax Committee for a few years, and I was there when you as a freshman came on, and so here you are as chair, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Question for you in relation to the task force that you're eliminating. My understanding that this bill, even though there are many requests for local option sales tax, this bill is void of any of them in lieu of having this task force be created. And a couple of things in addition to that, your committee also approved basically two of the largest local option sales tax provisions in regards to transportation and housing, which kind of gives the state the first bite of the apple for a lot of these towns that may want to try to pass it later, because the state can issue it without having to go to the taxpayers for a referendum, whereas local options do. Why did you remove that piece, and are you concerned with how the sales taxes that are being approved in transportation and housing, how it may impact other local option sales tax options later on?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and Representative Petersburg. Thank you for the question. So not everybody probably tunes into the property tax division, so maybe not everyone saw my great speech I gave about local option sales taxes. But so the thing about these is that part of our original Minnesota Miracle deal in the 1970s to ensure that all children across the state had access to a high quality education, regardless of whether they lived like I do in a very high adjusted net tax capacity. I have a high property tax base in my community, and other places just don't have that. And so there was a decision made in 1970 that, you know what, we're actually not just going to leave this to the coincidence of where a child is born. We're going to take a greater responsibility as a state to adequately and equally fund education. And in exchange, that means that there weren't local option sales taxes, except in cities of the first class for about 40 years or so, from the 70s through the 2000s. And then, you know, I think that in the early 2000s, there was some budget trickery. I mean, I'm just going to say that took place around education funding. And what you saw was that, you know, the contribution from the state, which, by the way, is our obligation under the Constitution. The state is to provide an adequate education to every child in Minnesota. And our commitment to that, the dollars, because of a deficit that we had and because of an unwillingness to raise adequate revenue to fund that, went down, down, down. And what you have in exchange is property tax levies going up and up and up. And so, you know, we're getting back to a point where because of the over-reliance on these property tax levies, there, you know, more of the that question of whether somebody has access to good public services is left up to where they live and what the geography and what the kind of tax base in their community is. And so, you know, the reason that I want us to kind of take a step back from and just take a bigger look at how it is that we're funding our local governments is about this issue of equalization. So there are these questions about the relative regressivity or progressivity of our of the tax tools that we use. And the reality is that 13 of our 15 major tax types, major revenue raisers, are regressive. And a healthy revenue system relies on a kind of a diverse mix of these tax types. And so, you know, I mean, you kind of asked me two questions. So I'm answering the question about the transportation and housing bills. And so the difference to me and, you know, between an individual city coming in and asking for the ability to levy a local option sales tax versus taking the entire 7-county metro area, which includes hundreds of cities, and saying that together we're going to pool this money and distribute it for really, you know, important critical needs in transportation and housing. And, you know, while we have a surplus in the general fund and that revenue stream's going up, all of the constitutionally dedicated, and you know this, right, because you're on transportation, all the constitutionally dedicated revenue sources for transportation are going down, down, down. And so we have a real problem in that area. So, you know, I think that I don't have the same objection to an individual city or the same questions. I mean, it's not an objection, right, but to an individual city coming in and making a proposal about local option sales taxes versus, like, you know, something like 55 or 60% of the population of our state all kind of paying into a pot where then there is that equalization, that history of equalization that I talked about with the Minnesota Miracle can happen. As for the local sales tax task force, you know, that's sort of about kind of conversations with, you know, we introduced it, we had a hearing on it, it was in the property tax division report, it was in my initial DE, and we're taking it out just kind of based on conversations that I've been having with, you know, with folks on our, in both bodies about the best way to move forward on local sales taxes.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I won't debate this now. We'll have more time on the floor to talk about that. But it does seem like it's a little contradictive. The housing, though, does get all of its funding from general fund, and so it's not transportation that just has lost. And it does seem contradictory that one of the reasons why you refrained from offering any local option sales tax to communities was because you were going to have this task force that's going to revamp it. And now you're pulling that back and not putting any local option sales tax and allowing the state to come in and getting the first bite of the apple to raise sales tax 1% within the metropolitan county area. And if any town within that community, which in order to get a local option sales tax still has to go back for a referendum, you could see where it's going to be much more difficult for them to get that done. And so it seems a little bit unfair to give the state that first bite of the apple. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And hello, Representative Gomez.
Good morning.
Chair Gomez. I'm wondering, you changed in the amendment for today, you changed the qualifications for the child and working family credit.
Yes.
If you could explain why the change from, I think it was 19 to 18, if you could kind of give us an idea how that practically works out and why the changes.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and thank you, Representative Scott, for the question. So as I'm trying to remember, I believe that it was Representative Norris who brought forward a bill so our working family tax credit is based on the earned income tax credit at the federal level. And so for most purposes, we kind of align with their definitions and the eligibility. But one of the kind of interesting things is that even if you would otherwise qualify for the earned income tax credit at the federal level, if you're 18 years old or if you're above 65, you are excluded because of your age. And so, you know, there are people who are 18 who are raising families, who are low income, who would otherwise qualify for this credit. There are people who are 65 plus who are raising dependents, who are, you know, lower income and who would otherwise qualify for this credit, but because of the federal definitions, they're excluded. And so we always were kind of, you know, as we were putting our spreadsheet together, that was always kind of in the mix of what we were talking about. We had a hearing on the bill in the tax committee. But we sort of, as I said, you know, it was kind of just an error. As we got down the road, we realized that we were carrying a number on our spreadsheet that included those 18-year-olds and those elders who would otherwise qualify, but the language didn't align with the number we were carrying in the spreadsheet. And so this brings them, you know, this just clarifies that the number that we're carrying on the spreadsheet actually did include the 65-plus and the 18-year-olds, and so we just added them to the language.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, because that was my next question, which was this reflected in the spreadsheet. But what you're saying is it was already reflected in the spreadsheet, but the language didn't line up with that number that you had in the spreadsheet. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative Krusha.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Scott. I thought the thank you, Madam Chair, was you were done.
Oh, no.
Representative Scott.
No, I was asking that, just verifying that the answer to that question.
Yeah. Representative Scott.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and Madam Chair Gomez. So I'm just, again, trying to just reiterate what you said. The spreadsheet was reflecting the changes of the amendment that you offered today.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Olson and Representative Scott. Yes, it was, honestly, we've been through about like 20 changes to this thing, so it was just an error, but it was kind of a bank error in our favor because it meant that we could include, you know, these folks that we know are working hard, raising dependents and are lower income, so those 18-year-olds and those 65 plus people. So it's, I mean, I'm actually really excited about this. I think it's a really good thing that we're able to extend those benefits to more who would otherwise be eligible if not for their age.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And another question would be, is the additional money being appropriated to nonprofits for tax outreach reflected in the spreadsheet? And if so, where would we find that?
Representative Gomez.
Yes, Chair Olson and Representative Scott, yes. The increase to the taxpayer assistance is reflected on the spreadsheet. I'm just going to try to find it here quick.
Ms. Schill here.
Oh, Ms. Schill's going to find it for me. That's better.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Staff. If you take a look at the spreadsheet, tax aids and credits is, let me see, pages 6 through 9, and we are give me just one moment, please. Okay, I have in front of me the full forecast sheet. It's page, it's line 146 on page 10. But we have a summary sheet. Also, we have two spreadsheets, Madam Chair.
Oh, there it is.
It's line 15, Madam Chair, on page 5 of the summary of change item spreadsheet.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's it.
Representative Krusha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Gomez, for presenting the bill. Just a couple questions, and I realize we're on the amendment, so I'm just going to have to connect some dots, but you mentioned some things in your earlier comments about the education, local levies, and property tax, and related to the local sales tax. I'm trying to understand what is, and you mentioned the Minnesota Miracle, what is your philosophy? Are we trying to take that burden, in your perspective, off of the local communities and more centralized? Is that what you're trying to do?
Representative Gomez.
Representative Prichot, so I mentioned the Minnesota Miracle because the repeal of local option, or sort of the limitations on local option sales taxes, were a part of that, and so that was the connection. In general, philosophically, yes, I believe that the state needs to be actually keeping our commitment to our local partners, to our cities, our counties, and our school boards, so that they don't have to over-rely on their property tax bases.
Representative.
Okay, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. So following that to the next step, so would you see that less of that, by not giving the communities as much flexibility and then putting a more centralized, so that's what we're trying to do. Is that what I'm understanding you saying?
Representative Gomez.
Madam Chair and Representative Krisha, as I said, I believe that the over-reliance on property tax levies to fund basic services, including education, the things that we all need, that all of our people need. I think that it's over-relying on a more regressive and more limited source of revenue than if we use, as I said, that kind of diverse mix of tax types that we are able to deploy at the state level. So I believe that that's a more equitable way to fund public services, rather than leaving it up to, you know, what your zip code is, whether you live close to a mall, whether you live close to, you know, a big retail base, or you're somewhere that doesn't have those resources. The kids that live in those communities that aren't like mine, where they don't have a big retail base, maybe where they don't have as big of a property tax base, I believe that those children also deserve access to an equitable education and also deserve access to really high-quality public services. Our access to public services should not depend on where we were born or what we look like or what our background is. It should be available to all.
Representative Prichot.
Thank you, ma'am. And I appreciate that. I'm not trying to agree or disagree. I'm really just trying to understand where we're headed pragmatically. So would you... Under the scenario you're putting together, would you, I'm trying to think of the right way to ask this, for local folks like my community, is it better to have them feel like there's a reliance coming from the state centralized general fund versus not giving them, it sounds to me like you're saying that local communities, we should take some of their tools for raising taxes away because the state's going to offset that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Gomez.
Chair Olson, Representative Krisha. I mean, so I think, you know, you know a lot about education funding. I don't know a ton about it. What's happened, from my understanding, in inflation-adjusted dollars since 2002, and it's the same in LGA. So that's something I do know about, local government aid, okay? $546 million is the number today, I believe, or 564. I maybe mixed those digits. But it's around $550 million that we provide to local governments in this need-based aid. In 2002, the number was $546 million. So in those 20 years, what that means, right, is that, you know, the cost of goods has gone up, the cost of labor has gone up, inflation, all of these even more recent things. But, you know, it's that was part of the deal of the Minnesota Miracle. And we have not kept up our commitments to our local partners. And I do believe that we have a role today. This legislature has an important role in keeping that commitment and making sure that, you know, these really critical dollars in LGA, you know, as you know, it's very flexible. It's really, you know, up to kind of the locals to decide what's the best use of those funds. But that thread about local government aid, you look at 2002 and 2023, it's the same in a lot of different funding areas. And it's similar in education, is my understanding, right? Is if you look at inflation-adjusted dollars over the last 20 years, what we've seen is the state share has gone down, and thus property levies have gone up, up, up. Because guess what? We can do what we want at the state, but those school doors are going to open. There's going to be a teacher there. Like, we have a commitment to our students in that way. So yes, I would say that, to the extent that over the last 20 years, we haven't kept up with our commitments to our kids, to our local government partners, to higher ed, for example, I mean, look at higher ed funding over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, it's a travesty, if you ask me, the way that we've underfunded some of these really basic public services. And you can see that, the reflection of that in what's happening, for example, in higher ed. You can see the reflection of that in what's happening, you know, with our local government partners and what they're having to do to fund public services.
And I'll wrap up, Madam Chair. Thank you. So, okay, now, so here's how I see it, and this is, I'll bring this back to the amendment and all that. So what I'm hearing is, part of the philosophy is, and this is what I would hear from my local officials, is by not having, going back to local sales revenue and the tax that represented Petersburg, our local communities are feeling like they're getting a disadvantage, like they're always waiting for the state to do something for them. You're taking a tool away from them. You mentioned, which is inconsistent, because last night we just voted on an education bill which gives school boards the ability to reauthorize, raise taxes on their own. So on one hand, here we are not giving them the tools. On the other hand, another bill the DFL just voted, let's let people raise those taxes whenever they want. Now I'll bring it back to this amendment. We've got language in here for an electronic pull tab, which these are dollars that our charities are using for the hockey teams, the baseball teams, and all that, and we still can't get back to, even with this definition that does nothing and everything in here, it takes the dollars away from our communities. The bigger problem is this. We could find a solution between the tribes and the charities on an interface that works for e-pull tabs. But more importantly, we could lower the taxes for our charities so that more dollars stay in. What I'm seeing with what you just explained to me and what I'm seeing in this amendment is the new Minnesota Miracle 2.0 is, we got you covered, but we're not giving you any tools in local. That's how this is playing out in the districts I represent. So I get all the Minnesota Miracle thing. Yeah, I've read the book. I get all that. But the fact of the matter, this is no miracle. This is just more taking our tools away from local units of government that simply can do this and have to do this because the economy changes. I get the state is going to try to do some things and make promises, but those promises aren't coming. And this tax bill seems to pull us away from that into more of a, we got you covered, but we'll see. And I have concerns with that, so I can't support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Precia. Seeing no further discussion on the A16 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The amendment is adopted. We have one more amendment. Representative Gomez moves the A15 amendment, which is the grant management amendment we've been adopting on all budget bills. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So I know we kind of went far, we were able to kind of cover a lot of ground through the amendment discussion. So what I'll do is I'll ask for just a brief bill overview, being we didn't actually get that, but we should make sure to just do a high level,
yes,
that's relevant, and then we'll go to member discussion. And when, I know lead for the day, Nash, has some comments before we vote. So Representative Gomez to the bill.
Thank you, Chair Olson. So we'll keep this kind of focused on high level fiscal stuff. I'm looking at the House fiscal tracking sheet. It's sort of the 14 pager, not the longer 20 plus pager. The date on it's 4/20/2023, 6:30 p.m. So on page one, you will find on line 9 the total net general fund cost of the bill. So you know there's a small cost in 2023, which if you add it to the 2024-2025 total, we get very close to my $3 billion target. I also hit my $1.3 billion net target in fiscal year 2026-2027. On line 13, on page 1 is line 12 is the impact to the stadium reserve account. So that on line 12, that's just the reduction in the net receipts tax for charitable gaming. If you go to the next page, let's stay on page one. So, sorry, just one more line I want to draw your attention to, which is line 7. And so that is the total net property tax refunds, aids, and credits that are in the bill. So there, I'm just going to go over like the few biggest kind of items. On page 2, line 30, is the tax reduction for the modification of the Social Security subtraction. If a couple that's married filing jointly that makes $100,000 a year or less will pay no tax on their Social Security benefits under the treatment in this bill. The line below it, line 31, shows the public pension alignment with that policy change. On page 2, line 20, is the one-time refundable credit payment of it's $1.25 billion overall. It's $275 a person up to three kids. On page 2, line 28, are the net changes to the child and working family tax credit, and that is the measure that will cut child poverty by 25%. There are two revenue raisers in the bill. The first is on page 2, line 19. It's a millionaire's tax. Those who make over $1 million will pay an extra cent on those dollars above $1 million. And the second revenue raiser is on page 3, line 51, worldwide combined reporting, which will ensure that multinational corporations that are stashing profits overseas have those profits brought back into the unitary corporation so that they are taxed as they should be. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez, and I appreciate, I know this is a lot and a big deal, I appreciate you doing that. Thank you. So we'll go to member discussion on the bill. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I'm just going to kind of talk about kind of two specific areas. But the first one is in regards to the creation of the fifth-tier income tax. And this will put us, I think, at third or fourth highest income tax level for the high level in the United States. And we can all agree, I think, that these income earners are probably the ones that are the most astute, the ones that have really understanding about how to deal with all of the issues and are probably the most mobile, most fluid about leaving the state we wish. Understanding that we are now in 10th highest migration out at 19,000 people net loss versus the other, it seems to me that this creation of this fifth tier is just going to make that worse. But for a question for you, do you think this new rate will turn that around, and how is that going to impact our projections in the future if it doesn't?
Representative Gomez.
Chair Olson and Representative Petersburg, first I just want to share a couple of statistics with you. So during in 2018 to 2021, during the pandemic, when a lot of people were out of work, our frontline healthcare workers were putting their safety and the safety of their families on the line. People in the food system were doing the same. We had really incredible kind of economic shocks to people. During that time, 2018 to 2021, those lowest income filers in the bottom decile, their adjusted growth income shrunk by 9% over that period. For filers with an adjusted gross income above $500,000, their income went up 117%. This taxes are not a punishment. This is not a punishment of people who made out really, really well, while so many others, while the vast majority of people in all of our communities were suffering. It's not a punishment. And it's certainly not designed to drive anyone out of our state. Our state, which the value proposition of Minnesota is about our quality of life. It's about our schools, it's about our outdoor spaces, it's about our healthcare system, it's about local governments that are committed to providing the public good to their citizens. Now, on the issue of tax migration, so we have, you're right, we have a net population loss from domestic migration. Also though, in the Midwest region overall, 9 of the 11 states, with both high and low tax treatment, are also losing population to out-migration. And people are going, as they are across the country from every other region, they're going to Arizona and Florida and Texas. And so this is not an issue that's unique to Minnesota. Minnesota has always had one of the strongest economies of the Midwestern states. you know, our population is growing overall thanks to an above average birth rate and strong international migration, which, you know, without those things, the picture would be even worse. But, you know, there's kind of like a lot of conversation about this, right? But the fact of the matter is that, you know, if the only reason that people moved out of Minnesota was for taxes, they wouldn't just be moving to Arizona and Florida and Texas, where it's sunny and beautiful most of the year.
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. By the way, California is nice and warm, too, for that reason. But I think that, again, just points out the fact that businesses don't look at things as a punishment or not. They look at good business sense, and they know that. And I think what you're doing is going to reduce that. With currently now 5% of the top income earners are providing about 46% of the revenue for the state of Minnesota, changing those by just a few impacts very well. Going on to the next section, though, is Representative Crescia talked a little bit about this, e-poll tabs, and how the court case and what this bill does is going to have a direct impact onto them. And because the state allows it to happen to begin with, I think the state has some responsibility to help them recoup from that. And so if for the future, I would certainly recommend reducing the tax that they have to collect by more than just reducing by 0.5%. And maybe we just pay off the stadium bill and allow them to keep a whole lot more because of that. Something for you to consider. My last question, though, is around something that you put in that's new, that has been tried before. That's the worldwide income reporting provision. For those around here that may not know, back in the 80s, there was an attempt by various states to try to collect income tax from income generated outside of the United States, which basically I believe this is doing it here. It got to the point that Britain and Japan started joining forces and were going to have a retaliatory trade wars and stuff with us. So there was an agreement by the U.S. and other states that we would use what is called the water edge method. In other words, only income generated within the borders is there. Your proposal about including that, doesn't that get us into a competition war again? And isn't that a really dangerous piece? I mean, I just think it's a wrong thing for us to do and something that could get us into litigation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Oh, I thought there was somebody to answer for that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Really quickly and pointedly, and hopefully short answers back, because we are running out of time. So really quickly, if you could kind of summarize for the tax relief for people that actually pay taxes in, because you had a $3 billion target. And in this tax bill, how much money is actually for people that pay taxes in a refund or a credit that actually paid the tax?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, so obviously the net impact of the bill, as I said, is reflected on line 9. If you wanted to talk about the refundable credits and where the value of a refundable credit goes above the tax liability of a taxpayer, I think that's what you're kind of trying to get to. I don't have that number right here, but so I'd have to do some arithmetic, but we could probably get that to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I'm going to try to speed it up. So, okay, so I'll look at this another way that's maybe easier that you probably do have. If we look at in your tax bill, how much are we allocating for LGA and CPA? So those are some big tax items that are they're going to local governments, whether it's a county or a city. They're not going back to the people directly, although I know you'll have an argument that property taxes will be reduced, but they really are never reduced. I've never seen my taxes go down. But in any case, if you could just let us know in this bill how much is for LGA and CPA.
Thank you, Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I will not make any promises about anybody's property taxes going down because we don't make those decisions, so let's not do that. Anybody who tells you that they can do something in a tax bill and make your property taxes go down, unless it's that circuit breaker of property tax refunds, is selling you a line, and none of us should ever say that for what it's worth. So if you look at page 6 of that slimmed down spreadsheet, On line 45, you'll find the increase in local government aid. You will see that it's $100 million a year with an inflationary factor that goes on in fiscal year 2027. If you skip to the next page, page 7, and you go to line 54, you will see the increase in county program aid, which is pretty much exactly the same except for the inflationary increase that gets added in fiscal 2027 is a little different. But again, that's the base appropriate or increase in the base appropriation for CPA is also $100 million a year. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Okay, so $200 million so far. Okay. Then I don't know that you said this, and maybe you did quickly when you were going through the spreadsheet, but what is the total new taxes being raised? What's the bottom line?
Okay, so, Madam Chair. So you would add lines 19 and line 19 on page 2 is where the millionaire's taxes, and line 51 on page 3 is where worldwide reporting is. It's roughly $1 billion or so dollars in fiscal 24 and 25, and roughly $1.2 or so billion dollars in fiscal years 26, 27.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay, thank you. So last question is there any permanent tax relief? And if so, how much?
Representative Gomez.
There are permanent tax cuts in this bill, yes. And how much, I mean, I would have to go through and do some math because I don't have that number in front of me. But certainly, on page 2, line 30, the Social Security subtraction is a permanent tax cut. There are a number of credits that you can find on pages 2 and 3 that are permanent tax cuts. I can go through and get that calculation for you, but there are a number of permanent tax cuts that will mean that people who need it, because they are targeted, as I said, we're not doing big cuts for, you know, those people whose income went up 117% during the pandemic. They're not getting permanent tax cuts in this bill, but people who are working class and middle class people who have struggled with, you know, their housing costs and their food costs and their transportation costs all going up, those are the people that this bill is designed to help. And so absolutely there are permanent tax cuts that are focused on those folks that need it the most to get money back in their pockets.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Final comment. Just, Chair Gomez, you had mentioned that taxes in this bill are not meant to be a punishment and you're not trying to drive anybody out of the state, but I would just remind you why we do the tobacco tax and why we've had it so high. It is a deterrent. And so when we tax our high income earners, it is a deterrent for them to stay in the state. And I have heard from dozens and dozens and dozens just in my own district. They're like, they're fed up with all of it in the totality of what's happening and they're leaving. So I would be cautious with your estimates of what it's actually going to raise, because I believe you're going to be falling short. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash for close.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Gomez, this is quite a bill. It does a lot of things, but I think it misses on some things that were promised during the campaign. It adding in a fifth tier income tax, and it's not necessarily just on millionaires, because if you're a single filer, it's less than a million. We're not seeing the Social Security tax reductions that we had been promised during the campaign to the level that we had heard during the campaign. There is a really significant change to the charitable gambling, which, as Representative Crecia said very well, it's going to hurt a lot of people who are doing good things for folks in all of our communities. There is an incredibly large number of regressive taxes that have been added. And the stadium reserve changes, I think that that's, I think we're going to have a full conversation about that on the floor, I hope. There's very little in the way of tax cuts for the middle class. This is not a bill that I can support. It's not a bill that we can support. I urge members to vote no.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, I'll go to Representative Gomez for a very brief close.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thanks for the great discussion. Looking forward to having more on the floor.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Representative Gomez, for helping us get through this. I know it's a big bill, and thank you to members for getting through the tax bill. So with that, Representative Gomez renews her motion that House File 1938, as amended, be placed on the General Register and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make technical changes as necessary. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill has been placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Gomez, for all your work on a great bill. And so our next bill is Senate File 2995, Representative Liebling, the health budget bill. And I know we'd said 11, but I think we can go to 11:15, but I know we're all trying to get through this expeditiously, but if we need to, that's as late as we could go to still be able to get where we need to go. So hopefully we'll get through it as quick as we can, though. So with that, Representative Liebling moves that Senate File 2995 be placed on the General Register. And that's your motion, Representative Liebling. And Representative Liebling moves to delete everything after the enacting clause and insert the language from House File 2930, the first engrossment. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Liebling also moves the A28-2 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. The last amendment is the Representative Liebling moves the A30, the grant amendment language. Any discussion to the A30 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A30 is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think this is the dessert, and we got about 10 minutes for it, or maybe a little bit more. This bill, we know the pandemic taught us a lot of lessons in this state and across the country. One of the things it taught us is that health is essential to our economy and that we're all interconnected. We are dependent on each other to be healthy in very real ways. So this bill does a lot of great things. It invests in reducing disparities so that everyone in our state has better opportunities to be healthy. It invests in public health to help prepare for the next pandemic and other situations that may arise. It has a really exciting healthcare package that moves us toward more affordable, more accessible healthcare. It deprivatizes our public health care programs and saves money that we now spend on layers of administration. For the first time, it provides resources to actually study the way forward in health care. And it reduces administrative barriers and covers more Minnesotans with public health care programs. It pays attention to the health care workforce, which is so critical to health and has been so stressed out and depleted by the pandemic. It has the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act, which is still, I have to say, a work in progress, but has been worked on very diligently by Representative Feist, and we're going to get this right. It has workplace safety grants. It has funding for EMS. It has a lot of resources for mental health. It has provisions to deal with lead poisoning, lead in our water. This is a great bill that meets the times we are in and looks to the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you, Representative Liebling, this morning. I have some questions here. I've lost him. Madam Chair, is there anybody else on the list?
There is not at this time.
Okay. I have some questions.
Do you want me to ask a question? I'm good for that.
Would you like to go talk with me?
Representative,
sure.
Do you have a question?
I actually do.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will give Rep. Scott a minute. I'm wondering if you could detail the changes to our abortion laws in Minnesota.
Representative Liebing, this will have to be relevant to the fiscal. Obviously, this is a big policy discussion and a lot of change. So if you want to briefly touch on the fiscal implications, I will allow that, but we are not going to get into a big discussion around the policy around that. Representative Liebing.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just briefly, we House Bill 91, which is the repealer of a lot of abortion-related items, has gone through a lot of committees. There is nothing in this bill that wasn't in that, with one really minor exception. But this bill contains the health statute-related provisions from House File 91, many of them, not all of them. And the fiscal issue here, and I could find it in the spreadsheet, maybe need help. It's a very big spreadsheet, as you may have noticed. And I don't have the spreadsheet memorized, but there's some savings to the Department of Health from not doing some of the reporting and some of the so-called Women's Right to Know Act, which required, some materials that they had to put together and so on. So that's the fiscal. It's not a huge fiscal impact, but it's a savings from those items.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think she's ready now.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, now open up your stupid phone. Okay. My understanding, Representative Liebling, and obviously I don't sit on your committee and have avoided it like the plague over the years here, but I understand that there's an elimination of managed care in this bill as it interacts with Minnesota Care buy-in program. And so I'm wondering that both of those things are going to simultaneously happen in 2027, is my understanding. And my question is would DHS be able to stand up such a large program change at the same time that managed care is being eliminated?
Representative Liebling, and that also is probably a really big question, and you had lots of committee hearing about it. So if you could speak to it as regards to the fiscal impact, that would be helpful. Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The entire bill is before us. Mm-hmm. And if there's policy in a finance bill, mm-hmm. that's not our fault. That was the decision made by the majority party. So I feel like the questions should be answered in full. Thank you.
Representative Scott, and she can answer it in full, but I think the conversation around managed care, Minnesota Care buy-in, all of that, I'm just saying we'll try to talk to that, yes, and the fiscal with the specific eye on the fiscal impact as well. So Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. So the Minnesota Care buy-in or public option, as I said about the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act, it's really kind of still a little bit of a work in progress that I expect, there's a lot of analysis that has to be done before we know, exactly what the parameters of that will be. But, when something's going to be implemented in 4 years, there's plenty of time to build up resources to do it and so on. But with regard to the deep, I call it the deprivatization of our healthcare programs, because we're not getting rid of all managed care, by the way. We're leaving in place the county-based purchasing. We're leaving in place Hennepin Health, the public run parts of the system. We are deprivatizing. And there is language in the bill that says that they can hire a third-party administrator to do this. But if you'll notice, we save a ton of money by deprivatizing our healthcare. And so there is, and this would be ongoing, it really shows the fiscal impact. It really shows how much we really waste in the layers of administration of our healthcare programs as we run them now. And so I think there's certainly time to figure that out, but it is intended, and it's always been intended, that they could hire a third-party administrator, not to take risk and all that stuff, and not to decide how to run the program, but to just do the administrative part of it, to have one administrator instead of multiple administrators with multiple layers of administration, who then, by the way, subcontract a lot of it to others, including PBMs, and it just is a mess and needs to be untangled for the good of everybody going forward.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. And would eliminating managed care be allowed by the federal government and allow Minnesota to continue to receive BHP funding? Do we know that?
Well,
I think that's a question to be answered, but other states have done it. So I think it's, you know, other states, I believe New York just did something similar. So I don't think this is, you know, obviously this is a really complicated area, but, and there's probably some, you know, interaction that has to happen with the federal government, the same as for the public option. There's a waiver involved and writing a waiver application. And, you know, so there's some uncertainty always when we're interacting with the federal government to, because a lot of our funding obviously comes from the federal government. So, you know, these are complicated things, but if we don't try, we'll never succeed.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, has New York been successful in working with the federal government to make sure that, you know, what needs to stay in place stays in place? If you said they're moving toward that or they've done it, then is that kind of a, something that we can look to see how that's going?
Representative Liebling.
Well, it's my understanding that we really, our basic health plan, the BHP, is kind of unique. And so I don't know that we have an absolute blueprint anyplace. But from what I've seen over 18 years of being in this legislature, I think we can do better than we're doing. And I think we can save money doing it. And if we don't, like I say, if we don't try, we can't succeed. So there's plenty of time. It's not something that happens tomorrow or next year, but we're putting a process in place. And we're asking in the bill for an implementation plan from DHS as we move forward.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And another question, Representative Liebling, is how does the pharmacy carve-out impact seniors and people with disabilities who are dual eligible for Medicare and Medicaid? Would DHS be able to provide the same services and the health plans that they currently provide for those folks?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think, you know, the pharmacy piece is a perfect example of how the layers of administration have gotten in the way and are just costing us lots and lots of money. And so I don't know specifically, you know, if a person goes to a pharmacy and they get their pharmaceuticals, they get their prescriptions, I don't think it, you know, all of the very extremely complicated financing behind that, I don't think that impacts them at when they get their drug at the pharmacy. It's kind of a matter of is it available and what am I paying for it? So I guess maybe I'm not totally understanding what you're getting at here, but I don't see it as being detrimental to anyone's health care. I think ultimately it would be extremely beneficial. And very importantly, this proposal this year is being driven by the small pharmacies who are going out of business because of the way the managed care companies are paying them, or more accurately, not paying them for dispensing drugs to their patients. So that's where this is coming from. All over rural Minnesota, small pharmacies are closing, and they are begging us to do this pharmacy carve-out.
Representative O'Neill.
No,
I mean Scott.
Thank you. Well, thank you for those answers, Representative. And my understanding is that many states are moving toward a managed care model, and we're moving away from it, and that concerns me. And I'm wondering, so if we try this and if we don't save money, if we're rationing care, those sorts of things, then are we going to move back to the way it was? And I have concerns about moving towards the government running everything in healthcare. And then we haven't even gotten into the data piece, right, of the government owning, you know, having access to all of that information on individuals. So I can't support this bill. I think the abortion issue alone and some changes in definition here for the Infant Born Alive Protection Act, we'll discuss that on the House floor in great detail. But I think this bill shows a lack of the right priorities, and I'll be voting no.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just very quickly, and thank you, Representative Liebling. So as I look at this, and I see the previous bill and all the other bills that have come together, the philosophy that I see is we continue to centralize and pull away from really the idea of folks taking care of themselves. And what I watch here as we really endorse lower birth rates, and you look at India, who's taken over China, one of the leading economic indicators is actually having a strong population and birth rate. And we're actually trying to reduce that population with policies in here. I see issues with the managed care, and I understand, I find it interesting where we say, these pharmacies will be closing. Well, it doesn't matter because we're going to have dispensaries, and that's a magic drug we're going to vote on Monday. So this and the other things I think are going to be harmful. I look forward to the House floor debate, and I look forward to talking more about how this is actually going to set us back and continue policies of the Minnesota miracle are not going to be good. So I can't vote for this.
Further discussion, I'll go to lead for the day, Nash, to close out.
That's such a strange term.
I don't know. I made it up.
Lead for the day.
It's like I'm a temporary member of the legislature or something.
Like a pro tem lead.
guest star. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Liebing, I will just say, having been here now 9 years, which went by very fast, I know how hard it is to put a bill like this together. So while I don't agree with, well, I agree with the financial nonprofit review that we just put in, but I do recognize it's a tremendous amount of work, and I know that it's taken a lot. But from our side, I have great troubles with this. The term deprivatizing sends a shiver up my spine because I don't think that it puts things in the right direction. You know, one of my big hang-ups on this, having served on the hospital board in my city, is just some of the staffing ratios and the other piece that's in here also on how mergers happen or don't happen. I find that to be really troublesome because there are, I think it was written towards one merger, and now it's gonna catch up a lot of other mergers. The cost, because there will be costs around the expanded abortion efforts in here, are deeply, deeply troubling. And to be quite honest, this bill fundamentally rewrites health care in our state. And I will say to not just the Ways and Means Chair, because you don't get to decide this, but I hope that when these two bills that we've heard today are calendared, that you calendar just one per day, because I know that my team here, our team here, have things to say on both of them, but there's a ton of other folks that want to have a much fuller discussion. So I really hope that you send that message clearly, because, I mean, this is, I think this might be more pages than War and Peace and Moby Dick put together. And I just can't support it, Madam Chair. I know it took a lot of work to do, but it is just such a paradigmatic shift for our state that I can't support it. And I look forward to a very healthy, very robust, bring a lot of coffee to the floor discussion day. Members, please vote no.
Seeing no further discussion, I'll go to Representative Liebling for closing word on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I also look forward to the floor debate. I just want to make couple corrections here. One, there are no staffing ratios in this bill. The other is that when we're talking about deprivatization, we're talking about our public programs. They are public. They are paid for with public dollars. We do a lot here to deal with our public programs. So when I'm talking about deprivatization, I'm talking about our public programs. Just want to make that very clear. So thank you very much for the discussion, and I look forward to support on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, and thanks for all your work on this bill. And with that, Representative Liebling renews her motion that Senate File 2995, as amended, be placed on the General Register and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any technical changes as necessary. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and Senate File 2995, as amended, has been placed on the General Register. And we don't have any more, but I do have Representative O'Neill wants to be recognized before I close this out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe last week sometime I had asked for the tally of how much we're increasing in fees and taxes, and I do have that spreadsheet. I know the media was really interested in that. I had a couple media outlets asking me about what that number was. And so I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, is this spreadsheet now on our website?
So Representative O'Neill. I can go to Ms. Adrian's, but just to your, just so everyone's clear, we're referring to the, we had a handout today that every member has in their packet, a spreadsheet related to that. Ms. Adrian's.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill. We've been, it's still a work in progress, but we will send the final, we just wanted to get some information out to all of you and all the members. And so as we continue to refine it, we will have it soon. We'll post it to our spreadsheet, and then we will send it out for members and post to the Ways and Means Committee webpage as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So since it's not there, I'm just going to, I mean, there's a lot. And obviously,
Representative O'Neill, we're not having discussion on the spreadsheet at the moment. So it has been posted, and we can bring it back up for discussion later. But rather than walk, we're not going to walk through this right now.
I was not going to walk through it.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I heard you say that this is not on our website.
It will be. It's a work in progress, as Ms. Adrian said. So all members have it in our packet, and we will post it. Representative O'Neill.
Okay, since you're going to post it. Great. So you're going to post it as is.
Ms. Adrian, we can talk. We can discuss when it's appropriate, when it's solidified enough that we can put it on the website.
Okay, can I just say the bottom line, the bottom number real quickly, just on the record so that we know where we're at in the tally for today?
Representative O'Neill, go for it.
Okay, so that's all I was going to say. So the total thus far with the bills that we have seen is tax and fee increases of $2.3 billion in this fiscal, and in the tails, $3.35 billion for a total of, for the two fiscal years, $5.668 billion. So that's where we're at thus far in taxes and fee increases, just about $5.7 billion at the top line for the two. So that's all I was just going to say, because I had to ask for it, and I saw the spreadsheet, so thought I'd read it into the record since there's a lot of interest out there of what we're doing. Thank you, Madam.
Representative O'Neill, and thank you to our phenomenal fiscal team for doing this great work on so much this session. And with that, we will be here on Monday at 9 a.m., and then we expect that to be the last meeting for a while until we have the claims bill and some other more late-coming bills that will come forward. And thank you, everybody, for getting through taxes and health in a little over an hour, which is some sort of crazy feat that we just did. And I know that I'm not mistaking it for I appreciate our GOP colleagues helping to keep that brief and with their comments today, too. So with that, we are adjourned. Please.